Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and my guest is someone who is probably better known in Chapel Hill, I guess, than any other person, and that is our longtime Congressman David Price, who is lives in Chapel Hill, is our 4th District Representative for North Carolina in Congress. So it would be fun to talk to him, even if we were just going to talk about his congressional experience. But David has revised his very important book, The Congressional Experience: An Institution Transformed. So, David, welcome, and I'm glad to have the chance to talk to you about the new book and maybe about some other things that have come up since the revised book was written and published. David, why do you – may I call you David, or should I call – Congressman?
Of course.
Congressman.
We've been around each other a long time, and in fact, we shared a lot together in the political realm as you and I first decided we might run for Congress at the same time. And that seems like a long time ago, although the more polarized politics and the the prevalence of negative ads and all those things, which you and I dealt with early on, turns out that was a foretaste of the future.
It really was, and your book covers not only your in such a wonderful way your first campaign by both primary and general election, but what's happened since then. But tell us, David, why'd you write a book, and why'd you need to revise it?
Well, it's a good question, and I've asked myself that. To tell you the truth, I have a friend from way back named Larry Dodd, political scientist, and he when I first got elected to Congress, he urged me to keep notes, and he edits a book that comes out every 4 years called Congress Reconsidered, and he asked me to contribute a chapter on what it's like to run for Congress and to break into the institution, the two very different kinds of politics. Engages in, first of all, to get elected, but then to situate yourself in the House. And I thought, I don't need that, really. I don't need to anything else. But he persuaded me, and so I did write a chapter for his book. And then
so this was sort of like the first couple of chapters, first two or three chapters of your book on getting elected and then finding out what you do once you have been elected. Understanding
that's
what
true, and that's true. And I've left a lot of that in the book. I've shortened it some, but it's there, and readers seem to enjoy that. I give the text of such things as the radio ad we first ran with a marching band that mentioned my name probably a couple of dozen times. The experience convinced me that it was worthwhile and that I was probably one of the few people who could write such a book, given the one foot in Congress and one foot in political science. So I kind of warmed up to it and did successive editions. The second one was after I had been defeated electorally and had made a comeback, so that gave that edition a theme. The third edition was after I'd gotten more into foreign policy, and also I did more reflecting on topics that were important, I thought, religion and politics, the ethics of public service, the need for electoral and political reform, and in the last edition, of course, it's been 15 years since that third edition, so the last edition was especially challenging to write. Not just because time has gone by, but also because I've become a more senior member. I'm in more leadership positions now. That's a different perspective. But also the country's gone through so much. This latest edition covers the Obama and the Trump years. It covers three turnovers in House leadership. It treats increasing polarization in our politics, both in Congress and beyond, and the consequences of that. So I just felt like it was more than overdue to to do a revised edition for this next generation of students and for people who have a particular interest also in North Carolina politics and what we've been through here.
Well, it has been an interesting experience. But I'll forget this if I don't bring it up right now, but one of the things that just, well, you mentioned you're a senior leader in Congress now based on the time that you served and also the willingness that you've had to take on hardest assignments. But I just had to laugh when I read your account of sort of breaking in and trying to get a good committee assignment and getting on the list of to find out who the people who are really going to make the appointment or have influence on making the appointment. And in I guess this was really in your sort of your first big campaign, maybe in your second term, but first big campaign to get a senior committee assignment. And one of the people who you were competing against this was a young congresswoman named Nancy Pelosi.
That's right, and I actually came in ahead of her.
Yes, yeah, you came.
I wouldn't say that too often, I guess, but it is
true. It's in the book. It's in the book.
It's in the book. There were five of us running for a seat on the Appropriations Committee, and of course we both got on, but there was a very complicated procedure. I do talk about the hard-charging speaker who was coming in just as I got there, Jim Wright of Texas, but he came on hard times within the institution, thanks partly to a young guy named Newt Gingrich who took aim at him. And the next speaker, Tom Foley, was much more relaxed about dominating things like appropriations appointments. So we had something of a wide open race.
Why did you want to be on appropriations?
Because I saw that as a committee absolutely central to the operation of the House and the things I wanted to do in North Carolina. Quite simply, it's the committee that embodies the fundamental power of the purse, constitutional power of the Congress, and it there's some attractive features. It's less partisan and less polarized than other committees. It's more people get down to business and do the work of the country because we have to pass our bills every year, and it has tremendous potential to do good. I mean, most of our programs, it's not just whether you have them or not, it's how generously you fund them and how you oversee them and make sure they work. And so appropriations is really the part of the matter as far as I'm concerned. Also, North Carolina and our region were not adequately represented on the committee. That was another reason. I had thought about energy and commerce and other important committees, but this one was the best case for me. And fortunately, at the beginning of my third term, I got on.
One of the concepts that you talk about in your book is the difference between a workhorse and a show horse. And what do you mean by that?
Well, the term goes back, I think, to Sam Rayburn, the legendary Speaker of the House, Sam Rayburn, who once gruffly said, "This place is full of show horses," basically, because he greatly preferred people who did their work and specialized in their committee areas and contributed to the institution as opposed to always playing to the gallery. I make a couple of points about that in the book, because I think there still is a rough distinction between the styles of members that fits that, but it isn't what it used to be. I mean, we all have to be show horses, I guess, in Sam Rayburn's terms. That's one way to look at it. And that's not all bad. That's not all bad. I mean, we should be accountable to the public. We should have to explain ourselves. We should have to interpret. And we all do. And a member who doesn't pay attention to that is maybe not long for this world, because you cannot assume your good works speak for themselves. at the same time, we still need to be concerned about constant campaigning, the kind of constant focus on public relations, especially now with social media. It's possible to be a member of Congress and do not much beyond that, and to not really take on the work of the institution or the work of serious policymaking. So it's still a distinction worth making. We need to be both workhorses and show horses, I think, in the modern Congress. But there is the challenge of kind of balancing those two.
Well, I see a lot of your colleagues, often on the cable news networks of members of Congress who seem to have a regular place on the program of the of CNN or MSNBC or even Fox. And what is the rationale for making time for those kinds of appearances, and how does that time spent compromise your ability to do the kinds of things that otherwise a congressman needs to do?
Well, I think it's important to do. I do some of that. I would never claim to be a social media type. Nobody would accuse me of that. But we still have our daily menu of tweets and Facebook appearances. So every member, I think, needs to do that these days and to be present in these various media. And there's some who, I think of Adam Schiff, Chris Coons, people who I really admire their ability to just frequently appear and interpret. And I think it's a valuable role. I wouldn't take away from that at all. But just to take those two cases, I've been working with Chris Coons throughout this COVID period to get National Service, AmeriCorps, to get that beefed up to deal with the pandemic, and we've had a harder time doing that than you might think, but we've got it done now. And so Chris is a very serious legislator, and he almost became Secretary of State, as you probably know. So
he was
very much in contention, and goodness knows Adam Schiff is an accomplished member. I was able to bring him to North Carolina a couple of years ago, and we had a good time, and he got to meet a lot of people here personally. So, you know, there are people who do this quite successfully, and it doesn't detract from their day job, so to speak, their serious legislative work. There are others I think you'd have to say are more kind of preoccupied with their social media following and don't invest as much in the institution. But you know, one of the things about the job, and I try to communicate this in the book, is that this is very different from academia, in the sense that there's just this constant multitasking that one has to do, and you know, that can get frustrating, but it also can be very interesting and stimulating. But members do need to learn how to balance those roles and to do all of those things at once. And then you add to the mix a constituent service and work in the district. That's another component. I've been fortunate to represent a very diverse and just a supportive district. A lot of the things we do here have to do with servicing the needs of people in this district, casework we call it, or advocating for local projects. The morning paper has a long story about Union Station in Raleigh. Well, Union Station didn't just pop up in Raleigh. Union Station got what we call Tiger grants, the federal grants, which are designed to promote multimodal transportation, and we worked very hard to get that money.
Who are you? So, you say we. Who is the we? Do you mean you did, or your staff, or you and a coalition of local officials, or led, or what do you mean by that?
Well, I'd be very quick to share credit for something like that. But actually, it is an instructive example. maybe of the way this works.
I'll tell you what, David, let's take a quick break and then come back to the Union Station project. Okay. If you join us late, I'm visiting with our Congressman, David Price, talking about the latest revision of his important book, The Congressional Experience and Institution Transformed. David Price and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and I'm visiting with our Congressman, Representative David Price of the 4th District of North Carolina, and the author of the fourth revision to his book, The Congressional Experience and Institution Transformed. And it's an important book in many ways because Congressman Price is not only an adept, special, effective congressional representative, but he is a scholar. He's a teacher of political science, was and still is, so that he brings to his book not just the memoir of a congressman, but the memoir of a congressman who can explain some of the things about how politics in the United States work. And David, thanks for sharing the book and thanks for talking to us about it. One of the things that came up in your book was the kinds of things that you do for your constituents. And you, before I interrupted you, you were going to talk to us about the project, which is in the news as we talk about the Union Station project in Raleigh. And how did that come about and what role did you play in it?
I do pay some attention to that, and I'm happy to kind of flesh that out because it is instructive. I have in the book more detailed accounts of the two really the biggest projects of this kind. One is the EPA lab out in RTP, and the other is the National Guard Emergency Operations Building in West Raleigh, both of which were special projects that I think readers will be interested in how those happen.
Well, now you've got me off on those two projects, which are interesting in themselves in the sense that one of the things that you point out in your book is that things that happen for North Carolina have to have support from all angles, and from both parties and from both houses. And the hard work that you did for to get the EPA building funded and built was almost taken away from you because one of your colleagues decided that, or maybe two of your colleagues decided that they didn't like environmental protection or something, but they didn't support the project. And I guess it was Senator Faircloth and Senator Helms were not for this project. And how did you get it through when they weren't cooperating with you?
Well, Senator Helms had this famous quote: "It was fine for him to be for EPA to be housed in Quonset huts," and that was pretty much the attitude. Well, to make a long story short, winning an election called their bluff. Not in the case of Helms, but in the case of my opponent, Fred Heineman, who defeated me in 1994 in the midst of the Gingrich Revolution, and then he and Locke Faircloth. Remember when Senator Faircloth defeated Terry Sanford? Both of them campaigned against this EPA project and treated it as wasteful spending and all the rest. But then all of a sudden, there they were. They were in power, and they actually could have killed the project. And I do talk in the book about how that seemed to call their bluff, so to speak. The project stayed alive, partly because it was such a sound and important project. But they did come around, and then I won my re-election, my comeback election in 1996, and with some good bipartisan cooperation. I give full credit to a Republican subcommittee chairman named Jerry Lewis of California, who saw the virtue of this project. You know, the cost estimates went up, and we thought, oh my, we're going to have to cut out the high bay aspect of the building. We're going to have to cut out the child care center or something or other. And no, he said, let's just bite the bullet and do it. And we did it. And so it got done. And it is a bipartisan achievement. But as you say, there's a little byplay there that's interesting politically.
David, would you say that your ability to communicate with that California leader was based solely on your shared interest for getting the EPA to get a place to work where it could be effective? Or did you have to, did you exploit maybe your friendship with this person? Or was it just totally this guy thought this was the right thing to do and did it? Or did friendship?
I think it was a little bit of all those things. We were cordial. He's no longer in the Congress. Don't see him much anymore, but we were cordial personally. There was a staff member who has since passed away, a fellow named Frank Cushing, who was just the archetypal appropriations staffer, purely professional. He was appointed by Republicans, but he called it the way he saw it, and he saw this as a meritorious project that would repay the federal government many times for whatever we invested in it. And so the staff role was important. The culture of appropriations was important. The fact that we have a less partisanship there and more of a cooperative attitude. And then there was just some good hard work. There were colleagues in North Carolina and beyond. Governor Jim Hunt got very involved. I'll tell you one lesson of this for me was how, even though this was a major national facility, how much it depended on North Carolina players, weighing in and making sure it happened. I would not have thought that before I went through it. But actually, we had 9 years of appropriations devoted to this project. And I can promise you it would have died had there not been strong North Carolina support.
Well, let's move back to the railroad station in Raleigh that we first started talking about in terms of the politics of getting good projects done. And you declined to claim the premier role in that, but you certainly had a part. Can you describe how that What were some of the complications and challenges that had to be overcome in order to get that?
Well, the Union Station story is part of our ongoing saga here in the Triangle to get diverse transportation in place. That includes transit, includes intercity rail, and of course, it includes a highway network. But the Union Station project is multimodal in the sense that it right nearby is a large bus facility that's going to be constructed. It is the terminus of the Charlotte to Raleigh train route. Before the pandemic, we had four trains each way each day between Raleigh and Charlotte. That's a real achievement, and that didn't happen by accident. That's another story about how that rail got straightened out and all the grade crossings removed, and we got this Amtrak service, by far the best way to travel from Raleigh or Durham to Charlotte, and so Union Station is part of that, and it's part of the economic development there in the warehouse district in Raleigh, and so there are lots of local players, developers, city leaders, Mayor Nancy McFarland in particular, who championed this, and so a lot of cooks in the stew, you might say. And I have always seen my role as making sure the federal government was present and accounted for, and that's partly a matter of making sure that Tiger program that we drew on, now called Build, anyway, same program, and it needs to be robustly funded, and then to give strong backing to Raleigh's application for this particular project. And it came in three installments, but it adds up to tens of millions of dollars, which I think kind of got that project over the top.
Well, if you joined us late, I'm visiting with Congressman David Price. We're talking about the latest edition of and revised edition of his classic book, really, The Congressional Experience, An Institution Transformed. David Price and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Congressman David Price. He's given us an inside look at what it's like to be a congressperson or congressional representative. It's in the context of the recently released fourth edition of his book, The Congressional Experience, An Institution Transformed. And David Price, you've used the book to talk about so many things that have an impact on politics in the United States, and in particular, the role of our congressional representatives. You have a chapter on religion. And when you start to think about it, there's a lot about religion that intersects with our government, isn't there? What was the point of your, well, tell us about that chapter.
Well, that chapter on religion and politics has been in the book from the very first, partly because it is integral to my own background. My first campaign, the religious right forces were becoming stronger and more vocal, and I had to contend with that in my first campaign. But in a more positive way, I brought a faith background to politics. I went to a seminary and actually thought about the ministry and went other directions. But I always thought it was important to understand the kind of faith and morality that we profess really has got to have an effect on our politics. And I had an early lesson in that as a young person, my formative years, when the Hebrew prophets were rediscovered by people like Martin Luther King, and we Southern Protestants, with a very individualistic view of sin and salvation, came to understand that religion had a powerful social dimension, and moreover, that if you took that seriously, you were going to make some big changes in our society. And that was a very important part of my early experience, and certainly an important part of the civil rights movement more broadly. And so I, for all those reasons, I decided I would write about this in the book. In my first campaign, I was speaking to a group of ministers, and I was under attack from the a candidate with strong ties to the religious right, and so I developed a little talk about the positive relationship of faith and politics, and that talk to this day is the core of that chapter. I've elaborated it in various ways. What I try to do in the book is take the intersection of faith and politics forward, just historically, up through and including the evangelicals' embrace of Donald Trump. As puzzling as that might be, it's something I try to look at and understand, and then talking beyond that about what that relationship with faith and politics should look like. And it certainly has an effect on our political advocacy, the kind of passion we bring to politics, and the values that we profess and work for. But I also argue that faith has a restraining effect on politics. We understand human nature and its negative aspects, and understand the way the notion of checks and balances are rooted in a kind of Calvinist religious perspective, that political power is not to be trusted in anybody's hands, absolutely. And so that there's a kind of humility that we bring to politics. The text there is Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural, where he acknowledges, even this is remarkable, I think, that at the height of the Civil War, or as the Civil War was reaching its end, he said, this is a righteous cause that we're going to pursue, but but judge not that you be not judged. Both sides pray to the same God. And he had a kind of religious reservation, Randall Niebuhr called it, that suggests that even when we are at our most righteous, so to speak, in politics, that we have to realize that our cause and God's will are not one and the same.
Well, it's sort of a modest approach to your faith. It's how do I say this? On the other side, it seems like there's a much more aggressive, we're right, we're correct, and if you're not with us doctrinally and with respect to our public policy ideas, you're working for the devil. I mean, is there this, can you make peace with people in Congress who see things a different way religiously?
Well, that's a huge challenge, of course, and it's become commonplace to say that there's more there are greater differences within our religious traditions than there are between them. Because our major faiths all have their fundamentalist and chauvinistic aspects, but I do think, and I talk a lot about mainly Christian and Jewish traditions of bearing prophetic witness, a kind of righteous indignation at the wrongs in society. I don't want to take anything away from that, but there is also a sense that that we're all to put it in religious terms, we're all under God's judgment, and we should be wary of the pretension in ourselves or in others of total identification of our cause with God's will. And that's I don't know, that's an insight that you're right, we often don't give full weight to, but I think people who are serious about their faith and serious about these religious traditions have to acknowledge that is right there at the heart of a kind of biblical view of the struggles we have in this world.
Well, if you join us late, I'm visiting with Congressman David Price. We're doing it in the context of the recent release of the fourth edition of his book, The Congressional Experience: An Institution Transformed. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and I'm visiting with David Price. We're talking about his revised book, The Congressional Experience, An Institution Transformed. That's the fourth edition of that book. But we're talking about other things. The more I delve into this, David, the more I appreciate what an incredible task it is to do all the things that is required to be a workhorse congressman, workhorse and show horse congressman. Your book does talk about the impeachment of Bill Clinton, and you may have done that in an earlier version of the book, but you also talk about the first impeachment of Donald Trump. Now we have ongoing the impeachment. Second impeachment, the first second impeachment ever. Can you talk a little bit about what the impeachment experience does to a member of the House? I guess in the context, the impeachment proceedings start in the House, so you were required to spend some time considering this. What are the differences in those three impeachments that you participated in?
Well, when you first look at the impeachment experiences that we've been through, the first thing that might occur to you is that they have in common a strict partisan divide. And I say in the book, the placement of the impeachment story in the book is on the chapter on polarization. And I note Alexander Hamilton's quote, which both sides quote all the time, that the greatest danger of the impeachment power in the Constitution is going to be if it's exercised on a purely partisan basis. But then I do make the argument, and I realize, you know, I'm involved in this, so I'm not expecting people to just accept this at face value. We really need to look at it. But I do think that, yes, the lines are partisan, but they're partisan impeachments in very different ways. My own view of the Clinton impeachment, and I try to justify this, is that it was not justified. It was, Bill Clinton behaved badly, probably should have been censured for that behavior, but it did not rise to the level of the kind of constitutional violations that should be involved in impeachment, the kind of dereliction of official duty. And but I do give an account of that impeachment and of how it's just no question that it was a kind of positive partisan effort for a lot of Republicans, maybe not all, but there was a zest for this, a kind of pursuing of this that I think had a partisan motivation. Honestly, I can't come to any other conclusion.
How about on the vote in the Senate? Well, the vote in the House and the Senate. What was the partisan breakdown in each of those cases?
Very, very, very much along party lines. Although there were some Republicans who who did not vote for all the articles of impeachment against Clinton. I mean, there was some sense in the Republican Party that some of this was over the top, and some members pulled back. But still, as far as Newt Gingrich and Tom DeLay were concerned, Henry Hyde, who, despite his protestations, it was pretty purely partisan, I think, and especially when you then compare the Trump impeachment, which I think was amply justified, and the attempt to get the Ukrainian president to do his will with respect to the Bidens and the withholding of aid in that connection. I mean, there's just I think every reason to, and when that came to light, I can tell you there was talk, and I heard a lot of it in this district. There was talk from the first day Trump was in office that he was violating this or that norm, and it was a norm shattering presidency.
But
not every norm is a basis for impeachment, and so there were genuine mounting concerns about Trump, though. But the day that the call came to life with the Ukrainian president, at that point we all knew we were in impeachment territory. And so I give an account of that, about how that came about. So that too was partisan, and certainly the Republicans just weren't even willing to entertain the case. And I would say that's partisan in a negative sense, that really the case did not get the hearing that it should have, given the gravity of the violation. And of course, the current impeachment is even more egregious, and the violations are even more egregious. I just can't imagine, if this isn't impeachable, I can't imagine that anything is. And some Republicans, to their credit, are acknowledging that, and we'll see how many in the end are willing to vote to convict. But the impeachment, the way the impeachments go, are yes, they are very partisan, and they are indicative of partisan polarization. In some cases, the partisan impulses motivate the impeachment. In other cases, the partisan impulses kind of hold on the Democratic side. The worry about partisan effects has often held us back. But when the offense reaches a certain point, you've just got to say, "What's my constitutional duty?"
Yes, David Price, I thank you. There's so many other things that interest me, but let me thank you for sharing your experience in Congress, which is a special one, and for putting a lot of it into your revised edition of your book, The Congressional Experience, and talking to us about it today. We're blessed to have you in Chapel Hill, and to the country's blessed to have you as one of the workhorses in Congress. Thank you, David Price.
Well, thank you. You're very kind to provide this forum, and I appreciate it. I don't often get the chance to talk with such a an interlocutor like you have been, so I do appreciate it.
David Price, thank you. And thanks all y'all for listening. This is D.G. Martin, Who's Talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.